The Tom Woods Show, episode 697.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am committed to getting 5 episodes of the show out this week. We're back to normal, more or less. I mean, in terms of the schedule, not in terms of me. I'm not in any way back to normal. I've got boxes everywhere. I've got the Mises University program coming up next week. I've just got so much going on. But if I don't get myself back on a schedule, I'm going to go crazy. So I'm releasing this episode, even though it's a little bit late. One way or another, the 5 episodes are coming out. You know, maybe one of them bleeds over into the weekend. I don't know what may have to happen, but the episodes, doggone it, they are coming out this week. Now, this particular one, this on Monday, I had 2 people lined up to interview, and they both, I had to cancel them both because of complications relating to our move. And then yesterday, I couldn't find my mobile hotspot, which I'm using for internet until I get internet hooked up here at the house tomorrow. So I couldn't find that, so I couldn't do that interview. So, So I have several people I got to reschedule with. It's totally crazy. Not your problem, my problem. But in the meantime, this is something I've been wanting to do an episode about anyway. Bob Murphy, who you know is my co-host on the Contra Krugman podcast over at ContraKrugman.com. Bob, other than on the episode where he debated Vox Day, has, I think, either been on the show only once or maybe even not at all since we started Contra Krugman. And I got to get that guy back on the show here and there. I got to somehow persuade him to come back on. He's finishing up a course for Liberty Classroom on the history of economic thought over at libertyclassroom.com. So that's a good thing. I don't want to bother him while he's doing that. But anyway, Bob had an article not long ago on the subject of the profit and loss system. And it's important because I think this is one of these areas in which people are led to believe that we advocate something that is wicked, evil, antisocial in a fundamental way, and yet the opposite is true. So that when we talk about profits and the value of profits and the importance of profit, we say these words, and yet they enter people's ears as greed, 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 wicked, wicked, wicked. And I want to explain something about profit. If we were to say, we don't want a society that's based on profit. You get this a lot from people on the left, on the socialist left. We can't have a society that's based on profit. We can't have an economy that's based on profit. Well, my glib response to that is always, so you'd rather have an economy based on losses? All right. I mean, I know I guess I'm being somewhat playful when I say that, but it's so important to understand the value, the importance, and the function of profit. And when you do understand it, I think an honest person would say, I think my previous objections were silly, they were misinformed, they were based on my having been in a position of ignorance at that time, because now I sort of get it, that there is something important about profit. As a matter of fact, let's stop for a minute and think about the big picture. What does it mean in the grand scheme of things for a business firm to earn a profit or, by contrast, to suffer a loss? What does that actually mean? Well, when a business firm earns a profit, it means it has added value for consumers. It has taken a combination of resources, so let's say land, labor resources, intermediate goods of various kinds, raw materials, and it's transformed and combined them in such a way that people value that finished product more than they value the raw inputs. And so they've added value to these inputs. And the fact that they earn this profit is a validation by society of their decision to take these resources and combine and transform them in this way to produce that product. So that's a good thing. There's nothing bad about that. That's a good thing. We want business firms to do this. And when they earn these profits, they are in effect showing that the inputs that go into making these products had previously been undervalued. there was a profit opportunity there to combine these resources in such a way that they can earn over and above what they spent on the inputs, factoring in the time factor that we refer to as the interest rate. But the point is, the business firm has taken resources and done something with them that meets with the approval of many consumers, that satisfies consumer preferences. So there's nothing about that that's bad. There's nothing about that that we should lament or be angry about, or there's certainly no reason to be talking about greed, which has nothing whatsoever to do with this process. In fact, I like the way Bob puts it. He says, to bemoan a capitalist earning high profits is like complaining about a surgeon saving too many lives. If we think of the contrary case where the business firm suffers a loss, what does that mean? It means that the firm wants to produce some good, but pretty much, if not everybody in society, then a whole lot of people in society think that firm is making a bad decision, that society would rather see those inputs used in the production of other goods. And they think that the diversion of those inputs into the production of this particular good is a waste. It's a waste of the resources involved. And so the loss is society's way of saying, are you really sure that this is the way you want to combine these resources? Because a lot of us think these resources would be better allocated in other ways. So this is a way for there to be, you know, people talk a lot about democracy, but this is the way the will of the people, if I may put it that way, gets transmitted up through the production structure, that the business firm at the retail level realizes that there just are not adequate sales for this particular product, and they can't earn a profit on it, or they certainly can't earn a profit producing it in this particular way. So they have to go back to the drawing board, figure out if there's some other production process that might make it more profitable for them, or if there's some other related kind of product they could make, if there's a completely different kind of product they could make. There are a lot of kinds of questions that they have to ask themselves and changes they need to make to what they've been up to. So this is what profit and loss really amount to, and you can see that both of these, both things, profit and loss, serve a salutary purpose of taking the resources of society and steering them into production processes that conform most consistently to consumer preferences. Because we do have to reckon, even though we live in a world in which there is terrific abundance in many ways, nevertheless, it is still fundamentally a world of scarcity. We can't have everything we want. We can't enjoy all the possible goods that we might want to have. Not every one of us can have every single good he might want to have. So there are trade-offs involved in everything. What that means is that even if something that a business firm is producing might seem to, you know, let's say a guy from Mars just looking at looking at planet Earth dispassionately may say, well, that seems like a meritorious thing that business firm is doing, producing that particular good. The question isn't that in some abstract sense, is the business firm producing something that's useful and worthwhile? The question is this particular good that the firm is producing worth producing when we set it against what might have been produced in its place? We always have to think in terms of foregone opportunities, precisely because we can't have everything. Now, going back to, I'm going to link to, of course, Bob's article, and there are a couple of articles on this that he's done, so I'll try and remember to link to those, at tomwoods.com/697. Bob says that, and of course, I think we all know this, the entire economic plan, if we might put it that way, of society is far too complex to entrust to any one group. So this is why it's a good thing to have a system that disperses control over resources among billions of authorities. But at the same time, there needs to be some coordination when you have billions of people and each one is making decisions about production and how to allocate his own labor services and you know, what to produce and what to do and how to fit himself in to the global division of labor, there's got to be some kind of coordinating mechanism. And it's the Ludwig von Mises answer that private property and money prices are those coordinating mechanisms, that money prices emerge through the spontaneous process of buying and selling by individuals. That process yields you prices. That's where prices come from. They're not dictated by, or at least they don't have to be dictated by, any political authority, and when they are, that always causes chaos. They emerge spontaneously from the normal buying and selling process of a vast majority of individuals, of a great bulk of individuals, and the result is a system that allows entrepreneurs to figure out what it seems like is the best thing to produce. That when entrepreneurs can't be infallible, but they can take a look at the array of existing prices, prices of outputs, prices of inputs, and use that as data to reckon, to figure out what makes sense, what will be likely to earn them a profit for them to produce. The profit and loss system also helps to keep entrepreneurs from making ridiculous, ludicrous decisions that would be harmful and wasteful. Bob gives the example of, let's say, people who are building apartment buildings, and they want to, let's say, paint the walls, or let's say they're going to coat the interiors of these apartments with solid gold. Now, surely there would be some people who would love to have an apartment coated in solid gold, but would there be enough of those people to make that kind of decision economically sensible? Probably not, which is why you don't see apartments that are coated in solid gold. That's because gold is simply too expensive for, the price is just too high for it to make sense as a wall coating in an apartment. But the mere fact that gold's price is high does not mean that gold, therefore, is too expensive to be used in any production process whatsoever. We know that gold jewelry can be highly profitable. And that's because people who are in the market for jewelry are indeed prepared to pay for gold, and they're prepared to pay enough of a spread between what they would pay for a silver necklace as opposed to a gold necklace. They're willing to pay enough extra for the gold necklace that it is very much worthwhile for the jeweler to produce or sell gold necklaces. And in fact, the very fact that gold is expensive is an indication that it's so expensive as to be prohibitive as a coating material for apartment walls. The reason it's so expensive is precisely that other entrepreneurs are bidding so heavily for it in the production of other things. And so the profit and loss test makes sure that gold is used only in the production of things that make sense, that people actually want gold to be used in. People are willing to pay, people are willing to part with their own resources to acquire, and they're not willing to part with their resources for solid gold-coated apartment walls. So that would be a waste of gold, and the profit and loss system, in effect, steers entrepreneurs away from economically destructive decisions like that and makes sure that the resources are employed in ways that are socially beneficial and conform to people's preferences. Now, apparently not long ago in Venezuela, there was some kind of law imposed that was intended to limit profits. Again, there's no reason you'd want to limit profits. As we've seen, profit is an entirely benign thing. There's nothing about it that you would want to limit. But they want to limit profits to what it would be legitimate for a business firm to earn, to cost plus 30%. And that would be, they thought, fair. So, all right, well, again, profit is not something you'd want to punish, because profit means that you or your firm anticipated consumer demand better than anybody else. And so that's precisely, people who are good at anticipating consumer demand, they should be rewarded with more resources because they're the best at figuring out what people want and providing it to them at a price that people are happy to pay. So those are precisely the people who should have command over resources. That's a good thing. Now think about the incentive that's produced if we were to say everybody is allowed to earn back the cost of production plus 30%. Let's say there's some kind of limit like that. Then what you would get, and here's Bob's example. Think about local governments that monopolize electricity production, for example. And then they use cost-plus pricing. They say that their investors can earn a so-called fair rate of return through cost-plus pricing. So they can get their cost back plus a little extra. The problem with that, as Bob explains, is that it views costs of production as a given. So that is to say, there would be obviously far, far less incentive to want to look around and figure out ways to cut costs, to figure out how you can deliver megawatt hours more cheaply. Because if you know, if you're a firm that you're allowed to, you can charge your cost plus a margin for profit, well, then what's the real overwhelming urge to cut those costs? You're going to get your profit anyway. So this is not a helpful way to operate. Instead, just forget this cost plus approach. Just let profit and loss operate freely in the market. And the result is the best result we can have. It doesn't mean it's a perfect result, but it's the best result we can hope for in this world. Now, here's an interesting insight that Bob had back in 2010 after there was a terrible earthquake in Haiti. And Bob actually went to Haiti. Not a lot of people know this. He has written about it, but Bob actually went to Haiti for a week to help out and try and contribute to disaster relief using his own physical labor. And he talks about it in this article, and he thinks in terms of how the people, himself included, in Haiti might have helped more efficiently. He says that basically he, being the professional economist in his group, was the only one thinking in the following way. Everybody was just thinking, well, we've all got to go out there and contribute. And we don't want people slacking off by having everybody sign up for the cushy jobs like preparing the poles for building tents and things like that, assembling these poles. Instead, we want people to get out there and take a sledgehammer and break apart concrete blocks. And Bob says, well, to be a tough guy, I volunteered for rubble crew more than necessary, but I probably would have contributed more if I had focused on pole assembly, because I was pretty good at that. But the decisions as to who was to do what weren't based on any economic considerations or efficiency considerations or how can we produce the most help for these people. It was all bureaucratic and arbitrary and based certainly on good intentions, but not on the idea that, well, we've got limited manpower here. Let's try and see how it can be best allocated to produce the best result for everybody. Again, he says, nobody but me was thinking like this. None of the team leaders had to provide an account of the resources, including the labor of the volunteers, used during a particular day, and compare that to the amount of help, however quantified, their team had provided to the Haitians. In other words, there was no way for the team leaders to apply a cost-benefit test to their respective operations. And then Bob compares this to his job when he worked in the dairy section of a grocery store when he was much younger. He said that we were thinking always in terms of profit, and in terms of profit simply meant providing what consumers wanted. We had to know, should we be selling chocolate milk, and how much of the white milk should we have available, how much whole milk, how much 2% milk, how much skim milk, what should the individual workers be doing. All these things had to be measured against the standard, held up to the standard of profit and loss to make sure that everybody's doing that job that adds the most value for the consumer. So there's nothing to be upset about with profit. And in fact, of course, when a firm begins to make significant profits, or there's a whole industry that's making significant profits, what winds up happening, of course, is this attracts entrants into that industry because people want a piece of the action. And so there's now more production taking place in that industry, and therefore the profit there falls because there's more production going on. The profit, in effect, is being spread around more, if we may think of it that way. And so that pushes profits down, whereas losses lead to firms exiting an industry, and then there are fewer firms remaining, and there's less production, and the losses begin to cease. And so this is how production is regulated by profit. It's regulated by the profit and loss system, that we get, in other words, we don't get too much of something and too little of another. We get production that conforms as closely as possible to consumer preferences, and we get that through a voluntary system. It's realizations like this that I think turn people into libertarians. Forget Austrian economics in particular, just libertarians. When you understand this process, it's so extraordinary and impressive and amazing, and we never learned about it in school, and yet it's cooler than anything we ever learned in school. It suddenly makes you rethink everything, at least for me. Just to think that society, in fact, oh, how about that? Society seems to run according to certain principles, and maybe it ought to be left alone to do that. All right, now here's a terrible segue. Here I've been talking about profit and how wonderful it is. Now I want to talk about taxes, which are terrible. But if you have to pay them, you can at least try to pay as little as possible. And here I want to do what I have pledged to do, which is to make mention of websites that people who listen to this show create. As long as they use my special link, check out tomwoods.com/publicity, and you'll see what that's all about. But one such person who used my link to get hosting started ajfreedomfinancial.com. And at ajfreedomfinancial.com, well, you'll see what it's all about when you get there. What I want to tell you about is that they will help you pay as little in taxes as you can possibly pay. And in fact, the creator of the site says, please mention that if someone signs up for one of my monthly plans, starting as low as $10 a month, I will build that person a comprehensive tax plan, potentially saving them thousands of dollars in taxes. If they don't like my plan, they can always cancel their membership. And also members of the Supporting Listeners program at supportinglisteners.com, if you contact Josh Fallenstein, who is with AJ Freedom Financial, if you write to him on Facebook, and you can find him in our private Facebook group, and you're a supporting listener, then he'll create a tax plan for you for free. So what Josh ultimately says is that it's his goal to try to ease the tax burden on people as much as possible, because he has certain moral beliefs about taxation, and so he takes that very seriously. So it's very much worth checking out ajfreedomfinancial.com. I will insert that as the listener website mentioned at tomwoods.com/697. Now, next week, I'm going to be in Auburn, Alabama for the best week of the year, my favorite week of the year. It is the Mises Institute's Mises University Summer Program. And I went to it in 1993 as an undergraduate. I met Murray Rothbard there, and it really changed my life completely. So it, to me, to be on the other side of things and actually doing some of the teaching at that event is a thrill I can hardly contain myself about. Now, the Mises Institute is making available access to this event for people who can't be there in person. They're calling it Virtual Mises University, and you can watch all the lectures, you can get and download all the slides that are used by the presenters. You can get access to all the readings. This is all with the exception of Judge Napolitano's lectures. There's no recording allowed. It's a very elite setup. You won't get that, but you'll get absolutely everything else. And it's for 20 smackers. And I think 20 smackers is an incredible deal for that. But if you, let's see, what day is it? Probably you're hearing this on, if you listen on the day of release, it's July 20th, 2016. If you join supportinglisteners.com, let's say between, it's got to be a newcomer. I'm sorry, not my existing people. You're wonderful people, but you don't qualify for this. But let's say between July 20th and July 25th, if you join supportinglisteners.com, I will pay that for you. And you can just get Mises University virtually for free. I'll pay that for you. You got to sign up and then write to me at on my contact page at tomwoods.com. And I'll do that for you because I love this program and I know you're going to love it too. All right. I got Murray Sabrin coming on tomorrow and we're going to talk about the Republican convention. I haven't been able to watch it. I haven't got any cable set up here. I got, you know, I've just moved into a house, but no doubt Murray is following it closely and I'll certainly have a lot of things to say. So Murray Sabrin on the Republican convention coming up on the next episode. So thanks everybody so much for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.